The world we live in is characterized by a war. I remember when I was growing up and taking history classes, pretty much as you studied history, you just studied war, like one war right after another. That's kind of the history of mankind. And when we come to Revelation chapter 12, we're introduced here to a war that most people aren't aware of. It's the war of the ages, we might call it. It's a great invisible war. It's a war that Satan has been waging now since really the beginning of time and will continue to wage until he's cast into the lake of fire. Call Revelation chapter 12 the war of the ages, or we could call it the invisible war. This section here of Revelation, just to kind of give us a little bit of context, Revelation 12 through chapter 14 is another one of these interludes that doesn't advance the chronology. We finished the trumpet judgments now in chapter 11, and we don't come to the bowl judgments till chapter 15 is the prelude to the bowl judgments, and then chapter 16 is the pouring out of these bowl judgments. But in chapters 12 to 14, we have here an interlude, again, that doesn't advance the chronology of the book. But what it does is it picks up the statement. You remember back at the end of chapter 10, John was told to eat that little book. And then he said, you must prophesy again concerning peoples and nations and tongues and kings. So that's what John is getting ready to do. Now, this is the contents of that little book that he ate. He's taken that into him. He's appropriated it and digested it. Now he's going to speak that out. And so that's what chapter 12 through 14 is about. These chapters, 12, 13, and 14, focus on key places and events and players in the end time drama. We have introduced to us in these chapters Israel, Christ, Satan, Michael the archangel, the Antichrist, the false prophet, the destruction of Babylon and Armageddon. So really just an overview of a lot of these key players and events in the end times. Another thing that's interesting to me is Revelation chapters 12 through 14 contain seven signs. You'll see that word, I saw a sign in the heavens. And it's the same thing we see in John's gospel. You remember in John chapters 1 through 12, we have the seven signs that Jesus performed when he was on earth, these miracles. So the same thing we see here are these signs that are introduced to us. Now, I said last time in our lesson right before we ended that the book of Revelation is the most symbolic book in the Bible, and Revelation chapter 12 is the most symbolic chapter in the most symbolic book. So for that reason, we really have to pay attention to how we interpret the symbols in this chapter, because if we get these symbols wrong, then we're going to run into some difficulty. I really think, in fact, a lot of commentaries I read, certain books of the Bible, you know, there's kind of determinative passages in your hermeneutic or your understanding. And when I pick up a commentary on the book of Revelation, one of the first places I go to find out what the angle or what the view of that author is I go and read what they say about Revelation chapter 12. It really is a very determinative chapter in your understanding of the book. And so let's get into it now here and discover some of this imagery. It starts out with the words, and a great sign appeared. So here's the first of these signs. In heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. And she was with child, and she cried out, being in labor and in pain, to give birth. So the first thing we have here is this woman who is clothed with the sun. Now, there are several views of who this woman is, obviously. One of the views I think is kind of interesting is Mary Baker Patterson Glover Eddy, as she was known, Mary Baker Eddy. She taught that the woman was her. That's a very humble view, right? That she was the woman and the child was her teaching, and the dragon who comes against it is the mortal mind. So I just mentioned that, not because that's a popular view out there, but just to show that you can come up with any view you want to about Scripture if you kind of throw off the restraints and the things that are given to us here in Scripture. Again, symbolism in the Bible does not give us license to go out and make something mean whatever we want it to mean. And now that's what people often do with these passages and get off into some really wild views. The three main views, though, of the woman here, many people take the woman to be Mary. Like a lot of Roman Catholics take the woman to be Mary because, says, this woman is with child and she gives birth. And we go on down to chapter 12 and verse 5. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who rules the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne. Well, clearly this is Jesus that this woman gives birth to. So they would say, well, who gave birth to Jesus? Well, it was Mary. The problem with making this Mary is, when you go on down in chapter 12, verse 6, the woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God so that she might be nourished for 1,260 days. When did that ever happen in the life of Mary? She went out into the wilderness and was preserved by God for 1,260 days, especially this is after Jesus had even gone back to heaven. So again, when you read the context of the passage, it doesn't fit Mary, the mother of Jesus. The other view, the most common view that people will find when they read commentaries, is that this woman here is the church, that this is the church of Jesus Christ. And as you go on down, they'll say that the woman being fleeing out into the wilderness for 1,260 days, being protected by God, that that's the entire church age. The 1,260 days is this whole church age. And so this pictures the church under persecution by Satan and being protected by God during this present age. The problem with that view is, the big problem with that view, is that it says here that the woman here gives birth to the child. If this woman is the church, you have the church giving birth to Jesus. That simply doesn't work. It also doesn't really fit in with some of the other symbolism that's here as well. But to me, that's a devastating argument against this being the church. The third view, the view that I hold, and I think is consistent with the context, is this woman is Israel. Now you remember back some in the early lessons, we talked about how to interpret symbols in the book of Revelation. And we said what you do when you interpret a symbol is you realize, first of all, that a symbol has a literal referent. There's something literal that symbol refers to. So our job then is to find out the referent. The second thing we do is oftentimes in the context of the passage, it gives a built-in interpretation. For instance, I'll just go ahead and mention this. Notice on down in verse 3, he says, another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns on his head and 7 diadems, and his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven. Well, if you go on down to this same chapter, verse 7, it says, there was war in heaven, Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels waged war. And in verse 9, it says, the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who's called the devil and Satan. So we're not left to our imagination. The great dragon is Satan, and these stars that he swept with his tail, they're his angels, so they would be demons. So the context tells us who the dragon and who his angels are. But then we said, if the context doesn't tell us, identify a symbol, then we go look elsewhere in the Bible. Go back to Genesis chapter 37 with me, and you'll see the only other place in the Bible where we have a woman who's mentioned, who's clothed in the sun and has the moon under her feet and has a crown of 12 stars. Back in Genesis chapter 37, you remember is the story about Joseph and his brothers. And of course, he had the multicolored coat, and his brothers were jealous of him. And Joseph has a couple of dreams. The first dream that he has, they were binding sheaves, and his sheaf rose up and stood erect, and their sheaves gathered around and bowed down to his sheaf. Now, as jealous as his brothers were of him, this probably wasn't a good thing for Joseph to tell his brothers. This didn't exactly endear him to them, but it was part of God's plan for his life. And then down in verse 9, it says this, he had another dream and related it to his brothers and said, lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. And he related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come and bow down ourselves before you to the ground? So the sun there was Jacob, the moon was his wife Rachel, and the stars here represented their sons, who ultimately, of course, are the 12 tribes of Israel. So when we go back to our passage here in Revelation 12, when you see a woman with the sun and the moon under her feet and 12 stars, immediately you go back to Jacob, Rachel, and the 12 stars or the 12 sons of Israel. It's a picture for us from the Old Testament, a clear picture of Israel. And it also fits because it tells us here this woman gives birth to the male child who's the Messiah. And Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6 says about Israel, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given." Jesus came from the nation of Israel. So this is really a determinative passage in your understanding of the book of Revelation, because if you see the woman here to be the church, you have the church being persecuted. This is all of church history. Whereas if you see this as the woman, this is an end time event where Israel is being persecuted in a unique way by Satan during this period of time. So the woman here, I believe, is the nation of Israel. And then the dragon here, clearly in verse 3 and verse 4, is Satan. And these stars that he swept, a third of the stars of heaven with his tail, I believe are fallen angels who joined with Satan in his original rebellion that I think is recorded in Ezekiel chapter 28 and Isaiah chapter 14. And so what we have here, though, in this passage is the age-long spiritual battle of Satan coming against God's plan. Because it says the dragon in verse 4 stood before the woman who was about to give birth so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. Now this speaks of the first coming of Jesus and Satan trying to kill Jesus when he's born. Obviously, that was he tried to accomplish that through King Herod back in the book of Matthew. But what we see here, and I think it goes even beyond this, is once God comes, you remember God in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, I call that Christmas in the Garden of Eden, where God comes and promises the Redeemer who will destroy Satan. And God says there that one who's going to be born of the seed of the woman, who's going to come and crush the head of the serpent. He'll bruise his heel, but he'll crush his head. So there's a promise there of the head crusher, the one who's going to come and destroy Satan. And as biblical history begins to unfold, it's clear that head crusher is going to come from Abraham. He's going to come from Isaac. He's going to come from Jacob. He's going to come then from the tribe of Judah. And he's then going to come from the family of David. So it's narrowed down. And Satan knows the family and the line that this Messiah will come from. So when you think about world history, what is the one group of people that Satan has tried to destroy throughout church history? It's the Jewish people. And to me, the only explanation for that is satanic. I always like to say that when Satan tries to wipe out the Jewish people, they always end up with a holiday. You know, he tried to kill them all in Egypt, and they got Passover. He tried to kill them all in the book of Esther under Haman, and they got the Feast of Purim. He tried to kill them all in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes in the intertestamental period. They got Hanukkah, the Feast of Lights. He tried to wipe them out in the ovens of Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s, and they got May the 14th, 1948, the rebirth of the modern state of Israel. But there's an age-long battle for Satan to keep the Messiah from coming, to try to wipe out the Jewish people so this head crusher couldn't come. So when he's born, he tries to kill him here, but notice she gives birth to a son, a male child who's to rule the nations with a rod of iron. So Jesus is born and he comes and he lives. But notice how verse 5 just parenthesizes the life of Jesus. It says, she gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule the nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and to his throne. It skips over the whole earthly life of Jesus. It just goes straight from his birth to his ascension. And the word here, he was caught up to God, is the Greek word harpazo, which is used of the rapture. So Jesus got raptured to heaven. So again, it just skips over his entire lifetime. But the point is, Jesus came and he lived and he died. But notice there's verse 5 skips over the whole life of Jesus. And then I think between verse 5 and 6, we skip over this entire age, the church age. Because it says in verse 6, and the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God so that she might be nourished for 1,260 days. Again, that last half of that 70th week of Daniel with the tribulation. Again, people will say, well, how can you skip in verse 5 from the time of Jesus all the way to the end time? Well, again, in verse 5, there's a big skip from the birth of Jesus to his ascension to heaven. And so it skips in from his ascension all the way to the end time where Satan is trying to wipe out this woman. And this is the ongoing spiritual war, if you will, where Satan, he couldn't keep the Messiah from coming. Tried to wipe out the Jews and keep the Messiah from coming. That was plan A. And then tried to kill him. He couldn't do that. Jesus came and died and rose again. So plan B for Satan is to try to wipe out the Jewish people, because God has made promises to the Jewish people through Abraham and through David that God is going to accomplish. So plan B for Satan is, look, if I can't keep the Messiah from coming, I'm going to wipe out the people that the Messiah is supposed to come and rule over, the Jewish people. So this is the age-long battle. This is the war of the ages, the war of Satan against the woman, against the nation of Israel. Now, verse 7, there was war in heaven. Now, again, I'm taking that this is future to our day, again, because it's looking to this time after Jesus has ascended. There was war in heaven, Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels waged war. And they were not strong enough. There was no longer a place found for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down. The serpent of old is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, who accuses them before our God day and night. And they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb, because of the word of their testimony, and they did not love their life to death. For this reason, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, knowing he has but a short time. So we go from a war in heaven between Michael and Satan and the demons, then to war on the earth. I place this event here of Satan being cast out of heaven at the midpoint of the tribulation period, because when Satan then is cast out of heaven, he comes down and he begins to persecute the woman on the earth for time, times, and half a time, or 3.5 years. So that would place this at the midpoint of the tribulation when he's expelled from heaven. A lot of people don't realize that Satan still has access, some limited access to heaven. You go back to the book of Job, probably the first book in the Bible to be written. There in chapter 1, the sons of God are gathered there before God, and Satan is there. Now, again, what type of access he has, the Bible never tells us, but there does appear to be some limited access. But here, Satan is going to be cast down from heaven. And he's going to go forth, it says, with great fury and great wrath, knowing he has but a short time. What is the short time? It's the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. It's this 1,260 days. A lot of times people quote this verse, verse 10 for current times, where it says, the accuser of the brethren has been thrown down. And we can apply that certainly to our lives. Satan is the accuser of the brethren. But here, I think in this context, the brethren here are the Jews. He's the accuser of the brethren, of these Jewish people, as he comes against them to try to rid this world of them. So there's this war in heaven at this midpoint of the tribulation, I take it, where Satan is expelled from heaven. And then down in verse 13, we have war on earth, as Satan comes down to vent his wrath on the woman on earth. And it says, when the dragon saw he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. And two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman in order that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she was nourished for a time and times and half a time. Again, that's the short time that Satan has been cast to the earth, says, from the presence of the serpent. Now, the two wings of the great eagle, some people have said that's the U.S. Air Force. That, you know, in the future, during the time of tribulation, the U.S. Air Force, the two wings of the great eagle will come and protect the woman. And again, I just mentioned those kind of things. I've actually read that in commentaries where people say things like that. And it shows, if you allow the imagination to go wild, the things you can come up with in the book of Revelation. But we know when we read the scripture here in this verse here in verse 14, back in Exodus 19, verse 4, and in Deuteronomy 32:11, the Bible tells us about the wings of the eagle that God bore his people in Israel in their journeys in the wilderness on eagle's wings. It speaks of God's divine protection of them. So again, when we see an image in the Bible that's not explained in the context, we go look for it elsewhere, and the Bible provides us oftentimes for that interpretation. But it says here, the serpent poured out water like a river out of his mouth after the woman, so she might cause her to be swept away. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened up its mouth and drank up the river which the dragon poured out. So the picture here is of Israel, again, the woman Israel, here in the end times being persecuted by the Antichrist here, or by Satan here, and the woman is fleeing into the wilderness for a place that God has prepared for her. And she'll be protected there, it says, for time, times, and half a time, or 3.5 years. Now, there's been a lot of conjecture about, well, where is Israel going to flee? Where is this place in the wilderness Israel will go? Now, I would not be dogmatic about this at all, but I do think it's possible it could be the area down in what today is known as Petra, down in the area in the southern part of Jordan. I've got a map here. You can see where that is in the southern part of Jordan. I've been to Petra a couple of times. It's an amazing place. There's an entrance called the Sheik that you go down through. It's a mile long. It's just a few feet wide. It's hundreds of feet high on each side. And it's kind of like a large sheepfold. And there are some passages in the Old Testament that refer to the people of Israel being gathered into the Basra, to the sheepfold. Now, the one thing that convinces me most, though, that it's possible that's where the Jewish people, this Jewish remnant, could be hiding, is back in the book of Isaiah. There's an amazing passage there in Isaiah chapter 63 that mentions Jesus at his second coming, coming from Basra, or from Edom, from this area down by Petra. Let me read it for us. Isaiah 63, 1. Who is this who comes from Edom? One man I heard called this the man from Petra, who's coming up from this place. With garments of glowing colors from Basra, the one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness in his strength. It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. And then they ask him, why is your apparel red? Why are your garments like one who treads in the winepress? And he answers, I've treaden the wine trough alone. From the peoples there was no man with me. I trod them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath. And their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments and stained on my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart. My year of redemption has come. So we have a picture here of the Messiah in the Old Testament coming up from Basra. And his garments are stained in blood. We're going to look at that in chapter 14. We look at the campaign of Armageddon and the blood flowing to the horse's bridle for 200 miles and all. But why would Jesus, in his second coming, be going down to Basra or to Edom to tread the winepress? It could be that he's going down there to deliver this remnant that had been protected by God down in that place. So it's kind of putting a scripture and a scripture together to get a picture of this. Again, I wouldn't be dogmatic about that. We don't know where they will go for sure, but they're going to flee into the wilderness. They're going to be protected by God during this period of time. So to me, this chapter really puts in perspective a lot of the things that we see in this world in which we live. To me, one of the main things that proves the truth of the Bible is the Jewish people. The Jewish people, they've been hunted, they've been hounded. There's been an age-long hatred and vendetta to wipe out the Jews. And you think, why is that? That you can't explain that naturally. There's never been an age-long hatred of the Irish or the Italians or any other group of people. It's the Jews. Hatred, persecution, pogroms against them. And to me, the only explanation for that is satanic. Satan knew the Messiah was going to come from that line. He tried to keep him from coming. Couldn't keep him from coming. Now he's on plan B to try to wipe out the Jewish people so that God cannot fulfill his covenants and his promises to them. So to me, when you look at a chapter like Revelation chapter 12, it really puts a lot of history into perspective. We see that these things that are happening in our world, they're not haphazard, they're not accidental. Even in our world today, tiny little Israel, the size of the state of New Jersey over there, about 6 million people living there, they're in the paper almost every day. And they're surrounded by a sea of enemies who want to destroy them. And a lot of that hatred against Israel can only be explained as satanic in its origin. But Satan is not going to be successful. God is going to protect the Jewish people. He's going to protect that remnant. And God is going to fulfill his covenants in the end with the Jewish people. Verse 17 culminates the chapter. It says, and the dragon was enraged with the woman. He can't get at this remnant that's gone to the wilderness to be protected. And he went off to make war with the rest of her offspring. So these are other Jews that aren't out in the wilderness hiding there. And to keep the commandments of God, who keep the commandments of God and who hold to the testimony of Jesus. So this may refer here to the 144,000. He says he's going out to go get the rest of her offspring. Or this could be another part of Israel, of a believing group of Jews, because it says these are those who keep the commandment of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. So clearly this is a believing remnant of Jews. So Satan now is going to go out and vent his fury on them because he can't get at this woman in the wilderness because God is protecting her. So you say, well, boy, Satan's going to be against Israel in the end times and trying to wipe them out and destroy them. How's he going to do this? Chapter 13 now is about these two beasts, the beast out of the sea and the beast out of the earth. And what we're going to see in chapter 13 are the two human instruments, the main human instruments that Satan is going to use to try to carry out his plan to wipe out the Jews and to dominate and to rule the world. And so we'll pick up there next time with these two beasts who are going to be the human instruments that Satan is going to use to try to carry out his evil plan.